Thanks to the organizers for inviting me down. I'm from the other, or one of the other universities in Toronto, York, up at the north end of town. And thank all of you for not sleeping in and coming in at 9 o'clock. Well, as you can see from the title of my talk here, I'm going to be talking about modeling in sensory motor neuroscience. I want to emphasize the integration of modeling behavior and neurophysiological methods. And as soon as the computer, okay. Now the organizers gave us certain goals of speakers to meet. Just gonna flash it up there for you to have a look at. And I was thinking about how to try to meet these goals. And basically what I've decided to do is give you an overview of how my lab has been using models to guide our experiments for the last, 20 years, including my training as well. And at the end, I'll come back to these goals and, taking those concrete examples, talk a little bit more about specifically how we can move towards the future in this field. Okay. So as I mentioned, I think my lab studies visually guided movements. So we think in terms of starting off with visual input, and obviously that goes to the brain, and we study how it uses vision to guide three-dimensional eye movements and arm movements. And I've drawn this as a serial kind of feed-forward fashion, but of course the brain is massively recurrent as well, and things that go on at this end influence what happens at this end. So for example, when you move your eyes, it affects your vision too. So it's really quite a complicated system, and the question is, how do we go about approaching asking questions about this system? Well, I approach it, I should say right up front, from a systems neuroscience point of view. I don't do any molecular work, so that's what I'll be talking about. But down to basics, really all we have is a scientific method. You know, we need to design experiments to test hypotheses. And the problem that I hope many of you already appreciate is that often the brain and behavior are just too complex to capture intuitively. And in fact, when we try to do so intuitively, we often end up misrepresenting what's going on. And so the solution that I guess we're here to talk about is using more formal models to develop hypotheses about how the brain works that we can then test quantitatively. Now, taking sort of a survey of what's been going on in my lab, what I'm going to do is give you some examples of where we've used models to guide experiments. And I want to focus on these key points, especially, you know, the importance of synergy between theory and experiment, and, you know, how powerful modeling can be to generate formal hypotheses. And also I want to talk about this idea of different levels of theory that I'll get on towards later in the talk. Okay. Now I want to admit a couple of things right away. First of all, I'm going to throw up a lot of models like this, and I'm not going to explain the details. I always tell my students, you know, if you're not going to explain it, don't put it up on the slide. But we could spend the next half hour just talking about one model, and that we don't have time for that. So it's just going to be sort of an overview type thing. And I'm going to start with, since training is one of the things on the list, I'm going to start with what I did when I was training in the late 80s and into the early 90s. But the very first model that I used, and I have to say my background is not in math, it's in physiology, but I've managed to muddle through like some people. And the first model that I ever used was a model of the VOR. So the VOR, the vestibular ocular reflex, that's when you rotate your head back and forth. You're able to keep your eyes on a particular visual target by counter-rotating them against head rotation. So here's a model that takes in a head velocity signal from the vestibular system, and on the output end is a pseudo-complicated model of eye rotation. And what was unique about that model at the time is that it captured three-dimensional aspects of eye and head rotation, and in particular some of the non-commutative aspects that I won't really get into, but there's some complications when you model things in 3D. And just to sort of summarize some of the main points of, this is going back to my PhD thesis, a simple prediction of the model, the eye rotates about the same axis as the head, but it turns out that because of some of the weird properties of 3D eye rotation, that has unexpected consequences. And one of them is that it ends up violating something called Listing's Law. So Listing's Law means that when you're looking around, you don't usually twist your eyes back and forth like this. It's called torsion. But the VOR, when you rotate your head, does violate that. And we confirmed that experimentally, and this has ended up being confirmed, you know, well over 100 studies in both normal subjects, monkeys, and patients, and had a number of clinical applications as well. And another outcome of that model is that it showed that you really need a three-dimensional organization within the brainstem to control eye movements. And there's this one thing in particular called a neural integrator that oculomotor people talk about. So the idea is that you have a velocity signal coming into this system, and you need to end up controlling eye position, so you integrate velocity. You know, that's basic calculus. Well, we went and looked in the brain, and we found the three-dimensional integrator. You know. So again, just an overview, but the reason I'm showing this is that in my training, it was instilled in me the importance of working together with models and experiments. And I've followed that approach since then, but trying to apply it to more complex systems. So first of all, another kind of overview, what about another type of eye movement, saccades? So if you're not familiar, saccades are the rapid eye movements we all use right now to look around back and forth. Another sort of black box style model here. With just sort of mathematical algorithms for how we do that. So the input now is vision, the output again is the eye movement. And using that model, we've confirmed the number of predictions that are related to coordinate systems within the brainstem for controlling eye movements, some behavioral aspects of eye movement. And one that I'm going to expand on a bit is finding that the superior colliculus has an eye-centered map of space. So let's expand on that one. Okay. So the superior colliculus is a structure located on the top of the midbrain, like so, and this is a sagittal schematic slice through the monkey brain. And one of the neat things about the colliculus is that if you microstimulate in the colliculus with a very tiny current, it results in gaze shifts of both the eyes and the head. This is just looking at gaze. So here's the vertical angle, horizontal angle. Each of these traces would follow the path of how the eyes are pointing through space after stimulating one point in the superior colliculus from a number of initial eye positions. And that sort of data has been analyzed to try to reveal what is it that's being coded within the superior colliculus in terms of gaze control. And traditionally, there's been several different models proposed for how things might be done. So one I'm calling a fixed vector model, so again, I'll be plotting these gaze shifts. These are now simulations, vertical against horizontal angle. And if you're looking more anterior colliculus, you tend to get smaller movements. More posterior, you can get really big movements. But the prediction in this model is that they're basically the same direction and amplitude independent of initial position. And here's an alternate model that the things are aimed towards a particular goal in space. So let's say 30 degrees left, 60 degrees left, 90 degrees left, but always towards a particular goal. Now, a great many experiments have been done to test between these two models, and the main story from work in monkeys with smaller kinds of eye movements is that they come out looking like this. But on the other hand, some experiments, in particular done on cats, came out with data looking more like this. Now, one assumption behind this, though, one intuitive assumption, is that this model is identical to what happens if you stimulate a single point on the retina. Okay, is what oculomotor people call retinal errors. Now, I began to suspect during my postdoc that that assumption was not correct. And in fact, we were able to confirm that through modeling and simulation, that if you simulate a model in which eye movements or gaze shifts are driven towards a particular point fixed within the retina on the eye, then for smaller displacements come out looking more like the fixed vector model, but the bigger the displacements are, they start looking more like this other model. Yep? That's right. So these are the trajectories. These are simulations of what we'd expect from stimulation. Yep, okay. So there's a sort of unsuspected pattern comes out when we simulate things properly in three dimensions. Okay, it was perhaps counterintuitive or at least unexpected, but it turns out that it captures the behavior of the data much better than the previous models. And to show you that, I'm going to sort of skip to the end point of our analysis. And take a measure of how convergent these stimulus evoked movements are as a function of the size of the gaze shift. This is going to be real data, but I'll show you the predictions of the model. So the space center model predicts things always perfectly converge to some point. Fixed vector model predicts no convergence at all. And then this new, or was new, eye-centered model predicts this sort of nonlinear increase in convergence as a function of the size of the gaze shift. Okay. So what do the data look like? The points I'm going to show you now, each one represents one point on the superior colliculus analyzed this way from the stimulation of evoked movements. And obviously the data fit best with this newer model. Now you can see how if you're just looking in this range and you had these two models, you'd say, okay, I prefer the fixed vector model down here, or if you had a few points up here, you might like the space center model. But in absence of this newer model, but with the new model, all of a sudden everything falls into place. You have one explanation. Now just briefly, we've applied that to a number of different brain areas. That's what I just showed you. Here's data from the LIP, saccade area in parietal cortex. It falls along the same line. Other areas don't necessarily show the same result. This is supplementary eye fields in frontal cortex. Here's frontal eye fields in frontal cortex. So it's not always eye-centered, but I want you to sort of hold the point that for superior colliculus and LIP, things have a fairly simple eye-centered organization. Now, more recently, we've been interested in testing using single unit recording to test predictions of our models. So to do that, what we've done is taken the kind of models, black box models I just showed you now, and used them to train a neural network. And we're looking at incorporating the proper three-dimensional geometry. So there's an example where I'm just representing schematically, but we've got inputs to this neural network model that are sort of quasi-physiological or physiological as we can make them, and outputs. And then you have this hidden layer, and you can train the network in a variety of ways to learn to do the transformation. And then what we do is analyze the hidden units as if we were neurophysiologists to try to get insights into what to look for in the real brain. And one of the predictions we got here is that the superior colliculus units should have eye-centered visual receptive fields with nonlinear eye position modulation. Okay, we've started confirming that lately, and just to show you some preliminary analysis, there's the data I showed you before for stimulation. Here's data analyzed in a similar way from the directional tuning of individual units in the superior colliculus, and so far we see them starting to line up along the same type of distribution. Okay. So keep that thought of eye-centered organization. I wanted to move on, though, to a different computational problem now, and that's the one that most people call spatial update. So the idea is that, say, suppose you look at something like this child here, looked at the ball, and then you look away. Well, of course, you can still reach out and touch the ball. You can look back at the ball or in any arbitrary way act upon it. And that can be confirmed in the laboratory where there's no visual feedback. So we have some kind of visual representation or internal representation of where space is and from moment to moment that's independent of eye movement. Now, one of the earliest ideas of how to do that is that you transform the visual information into some sort of stable frame of reference, like the body or space. But on the other hand, I was just showing you there's many parts of the brain involved in this are organized in more eye-centered coordinates. And there has been a model proposed, it's generally called remapping these days, which suggests how the brain might handle this problem in eye-centered coordinates. So the idea is you see a target, let's say this would stimulate the fovea on the retina. The target's then gone, so it's stored in the brain somehow. But then the eye moves. So how do you remember where this target was that would be pointing this direction? Well, what the brain would do is take a sense of this eye rotation and use it to internally update its eye-centered representations. So in other words, the eye goes left, okay, so counter-rotate this representation to the right. And that's called remapping, and it was first observed in the parietal cortex of the monkey. Now, we and others have modeled this. I think we've come up with some of the more sophisticated models. I won't go into the details here, but the basic idea with our models is that you can update across any type of movement. So, for example, if I want to remember where the projector is or someone at the back of the room while I'm translating through space, I have to update things at different angles and for different depths. So it's really quite complex, and of course, one can model that, and we're investigating how the brain does it. But I want to get back to some of the more basic predictions of this general model. And one is that I mentioned the monkey literature, but in the human, the parietal cortex activity should be updated during eye movements. And that's something that we tested using fMRI. And I'm just going to breeze over this. But work by Peter Middendorf. This is, if you're familiar with fMRI, this is called an inflated brain representation. You're looking down the brain, frontal cortex, occipital. We're interested in these two areas here in parietal cortex, near the interparietal sulcus. And we identify these areas which are responsive both for saccades and pointing movements and spatially selective. So left brain corresponds to rightward movements, right brain corresponds to leftward movements. And the question we had asked was, does that update across eye movements? And just to sort of cut to the chase here, what we did was have subjects look at a target and then make an eye movement before they pointed to it. And basically, we found that this activity on one side could be remapped to the other side of the brain, or the other side of the brain could be remapped to this side, depending how the eyes move. Okay, so it simply confirms the model. Now we can go on from this, though, and ask more clinically related questions, like what about parietal damage? If you've got this eye-centered updating mechanism in parietal cortex, what happens to patients with parietal damage? So slow on the computer here. Okay. So here's a couple of anatomic MRI scans from two patients that we tested in Eve Rossetti's lab. So horizontal scans. Notice this black hole right here. That means that this patient has massive damage to the right parietal cortex. And both of these patients have symptoms of what's known as optic ataxia. They have problems reaching the targets in the left side of their visual field. So what we asked is there a remapping component to that? All right. So to ask that question, we had subjects point towards targets that were always straight ahead, but we'd have them looking to the left or looking to the right, so the targets in their left or right visual field. Now in controls, the target would flash and then the subject would reach. But in this, what we call the opposite field saccade task, subjects would saccade from left to right or from right to the left, so in a kind of virtual sense, that remembered target is shifting from the left through the right visual field. So that should show up any kind of remapping effect. So these are control data. So plotting here the errors in reaching for subject one, subject two, with targets in the left side of the visual field or targets in the right side of the visual field. So that sort of just confirms the basic effect, shows that you've got a problem reaching to the left side of the visual field in these patients. But what about now in that other task where they make a saccade to the left or right and flip where the target is relative to their visual field? Now I'm going to plot the data according to where they actually saw the target. So if there's no remapping effect, it should just overlap with what you see here. But in fact, the errors flip over. Okay? So what that means is that in these patients, just by changing eye position, it can have a profound effect on their performance. So not only does this confirm the model, but it also tells you about something that these patients should be aware of. How they coordinate their eyes and their hand are going to affect how well they behave in real life. Now the last example that I'm going to go through is our recent modeling efforts. This is with Gunnar Blom on modeling the visually guided reach system. In brief, we're taking a similar approach again, taking visual inputs, using sense of eye position, eye-head shoulder geometry, doing all the correct three-dimensional transformations in between, and using it to model a plan for movement. And this was published recently in Journal of Vision. The first thing we did was confirm the predictions of the model that normal subjects behave optimally. If you don't do the correct transformations, you'd make big errors, and basically healthy people don't. But what we're doing right now is looking at patients at Sunnybrook Hospital with Sandra Black, stroke patients, to see, can we understand the specific deficits they have in visually guided movement in terms of parametric changes within this model? And once again, we've used this model to train a neural network. You know, these are schematic representations of the physiologically inspired inputs, hidden unit layer, physiologically inspired outputs. And we can train this model to perform as real people do and as our ideal model does. And one of the neat things, when you examine the properties of the hidden units and these units of the other layers as well, is that if you simulate neural recording on one unit, you may find that it reveals a reference frame related to its sensory input. But if you simulate stimulation of that unit or relating it to motor output, its activity is then related to the reference frame on the motor output side. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the technique you use will give different results, and they're not at odds with each other. It's telling you about how the brain works. So those are sorts of things you can learn from these models, which you can then apply in the laboratory, in which, in fact, we are doing. And my last graphic slide, I want to get at something I've implicitly been talking about all along here, the idea of different levels of theory. So this is another representation of the model I was just talking about. Now, in developing that algorithm, we looked at biomechanics, we looked at behavior, and to some extent, we were also inspired by how the brain works, because the black boxes in the middle here sort of represent things that might be going on in the brain. But then to get to the point of creating a neural net model, we had to take more detailed inspiration from the unit firing properties within areas of the brain involved in this behavior. And we simulated those as well as we could here. And then finally, when we do our sort of quasi-neurophysiological analysis of that network, we find certain distributed algorithms that I alluded to in the last slide existing within here. So we've got at least sort of four different levels of looking at things here, besides implicitly stuff I'm not showing, like behavior and so on. And they all relate to each other at different levels. And when we work, we implicitly know that. And yet sometimes we don't think about what is the formal relation between those two. For example, in green here, we're trying to say, okay, this part in parietal cortex, this part and this part, all might correspond to what's physiologically going on in this part of the brain. But it's based on a lot of assumptions and efforts that need to be sort of formalized, I think, much more than they are right now in my field, at least. And that's one thing we're trying to do. So getting back to the general goals of this workshop, one was, say, define the field. I'm not equipped to define the entire field of computational neuroscience, but looking at systems level of neuroscience research, clearly from the examples that I've shown, black box type models and neural network models have proven to be extremely useful, not only in generating testable hypotheses and helping us understand the brain, but also showing the way of what's the right way to quantify the data. You know, what experiments do we need to do? What do we need to measure? And some of the research highlights, well, I don't want to be so conceited as to say what I showed you were highlights from the field, but I've shown you a few examples from my lab, which I think are characteristic of what's going on in the field, and shown, I hope, made good arguments for how important modeling was in each of those areas, and also, again, for developing analytic tools. Now, critical considerations for someone wanting to enter the field today, and I guess there's a few of you out there who are interested. As with entering any field, I think you need to start by finding out what do we already know. Obviously, you got to know the literature, and in this area you need to have some mathematical background. I didn't have the proper background, so I muddled through and learned a little calculus and algebra to get along. I think the next step, though, is equally important and is sometimes harder to ask. What is it that we do not know? It's very easy to keep modeling stuff that we already know and keep experimenting in areas that we're very familiar with. But the big questions are often more about, okay, you know, what is it that we don't know? What is it that no one is working on? What is it that's being neglected? And I think those are the really important areas to keep moving toward. And if you're a modeler or want to get into that, ask yourself, you know, can I design models that will have an impact? You know, not just theory for theory's sake, but an impact on basic experimental work and on clinical applications. And how do I realize those applications? Well, from the examples I've shown you, by somehow finding this synergy between theory and experiment. So that gets on to the next goal here. What are the ideal types of training? Well, in my opinion, first of all, training environments that provide more than one approach, but in particular, training environments that provide this synergy between theory and experiment. And I was very fortunate back when I was doing my PhD to have that occurring within one project. That's not always possible, but at least have an environment where you can have collaboration between theoreticians and experimentalists and an appreciation between those two. Finally, suggested changes and directions for the field. I keep making the same point, more and more synergy between theory and experiment. And to get that, you need to have better communication and mutual appreciation between theorists and experimentalists. You know, I get this from both sides, you know, being dabbling in both. It's human tendency to think that what I am doing is the important thing and what they're doing somehow relates to what I'm doing. But it's just not the big picture. We need to put everything together in order to make progress. And how do we do that? Again, through these training environments, because it's something that's hard to pick up. And finally, I have a particular interest in having a better understanding of the relationships between these different levels of theory experiment. For example, developing some kind of formal theory for how algorithms that we can understand on a mathematical level are represented in a distributed fashion in neural networks. I'll end at that point and thank you for your attention. Oh, I'm